John Justice, producer Robbie, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM on your smart speakers at home and on the iHeartRadio app. Bumper Music Friday, playing weather-related bumper music for you this morning. And we thought it was appropriate because I know that Jeff O'Brien loves himself the rock music, our lawyer extraordinaire, that we would have a little bit of Scorpions this morning. Good morning, lawyer extraordinaire Jeff O'Brien. How are we doing this morning, sir?
Good morning. I'm doing well. How are you, John?
I'm doing just fine, having weathered this storm, and I was pleased to once again see that Toro the Conqueror had once again done its job. Toro the Conqueror, which is Jeff O'Brien's snowblower, at least in my mind, it is legendary. I don't know if it is for other individuals, but now anytime there's an opportunity to have plowing being done of driveways or sidewalks, I always expect the social media post from lawyer extraordinaire Jeff O'Brien talking about Toro the Conqueror.
Well, I appreciate the media attention you give it, John. I should clarify, I think you had talked about it a couple days ago. It's not a 1960s era. The thing was, my dad bought it the same year I was born. It's as old as I am, and he had it for many years. So I always, people talk about that Halloween blizzard of 1991. Well, my snowblower actually saw action in the Halloween blizzard of 1991. So. But, it's become quite the little media celebrity, so it's kind of funny that it gets so much attention. So I appreciate the shout-out.
What year was it created? Do you know?
1975.
Wow.
Yeah.
We may have to take we've been taking talkbacks via the weather, and we'll continue to do that, of course, and about the topics on the show this morning. But I would love to hear from you listening of how old your snow plowing equipment is. There's a gentleman that lives on the backside of my block here in Blaine. I've only seen it once, but he's got, it's a rideable snow plow. I've never seen anything like it before. I mean, the thing has got to be made from like the 50s. It looks like a kid's made snow plow, but you can tell this was definitely created to plow driveways, and I had just never seen a rideable one before. So I would love to hear from individuals who have old plows like Toro the Conqueror. So that's a deviation this morning, huh? All right, let's go here. We got a couple of items we want to talk to you about this morning, Jeff O'Brien. Before we get into local matters as it relates to the legalization of recreational marijuana versus our breweries, let's talk about this. It's a little bit convoluted. I'll kind of leave it up to you to add some clarity to it. But Supreme Court justices earlier this week on Tuesday appeared broadly concerned about the potential unintended consequences of allowing websites to be sued for their automatic recommendations of user content, highlighting the challenges facing attorneys who want to hold Google accountable, for example, for suggesting YouTube videos created by terrorist groups. There was 3 hours of testimony on Tuesday, and the nine justices peppered attorneys representing Google, the U.S. government, and the family of Nokimi Gonzalez, an American student killed in a 2015 ISIS attack, with questions about how the court could design a ruling that exposes harmful content recommendations to liability while still protecting innocuous ones. But whatever the Supreme Court rules on this is going to have broad implications as it relates to this kind of content on the internet, right? Right, Jeff?
Depending on how they go, you're right, John. Like you said, from everything that I've read, you know, commentary from the oral arguments, and oral arguments can be a really good gauge of where justices may ultimately go in a decision. The Supreme Court appears to be reluctant to step in here and, you know, find any sort of liability or scale back Section 230, this immunity statute, for these sites like YouTube and Twitter and Google and some of those. They appear reluctant to do it. And when you have comments from both, you have somebody like Justice Kagan and also Justice Kavanaugh saying almost the same thing, you kind of get the sense that this could even be, I wouldn't be surprised. They may have their own separate concurring opinions, but I wouldn't be surprised if this is 9-0 in favor of leaving things as is. And both Kagan and Kavanaugh said, essentially, this is for Congress to deal with, not for us. We aren't experts on, I think Kagan had the great line, these are not like the nine greatest experts on the internet. And Kavanaugh said something similar. So I think their point is going to be, if you want some changes to Section 230, Congress, you're going to have to do it and have hearings and weigh the different factors. That's not our job, which is, I think, what, as conservatives, what you want the Supreme Court to be making those decisions that way and staying out of the legislative process.
Well, and on a broader level here, let's set this particular issue of this hearing on internet speech aside. Talking about the makeup of the Supreme Court, the controversy surrounding the makeup of the Supreme Court, and of course the ramifications of what happened with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the talk in previous years of stacking the Supreme Court. This is a really good example of an issue that is could have wide-reaching implications, but you see the Supreme Court, regardless of political affiliation or, you know, beliefs, doing what they're supposed to do and working together and coming into agreement. And that's not to say they always will, Jeff. That's not to say that bias won't enter into the decisions of members of the Supreme Court. It is just to say that in a moment like this, I do find it interesting that you have Supreme Court justices who you would say don't fall along the same political lines that are actually looking at the letter of the law together in totality. I find that aspect of it rather interesting.
Well, and John, that's part of why the Supreme Court is what it is, because you have justices that have been appointed by, presidents from both parties. You have a mix of judicial philosophies, and the idea is that you get you reach these decisions. Everybody reaches, oral argument. Everybody has their own different things to say. They conference. If anybody's ever watched, any kind of documentaries or any behind the scenes as to how the Supreme Court deliberates, there's a process for how they all discuss this and try to, come to decisions and then take a vote and who writes the opinions. And I think that's going back to the Dobbs case. I think that was what was so egregious about the leak of the draft opinion, because that's part of their process. And I think that they almost felt like someone violated that someone would leak that, interfere with their deliberative process to get to a final result. I think that, and this is also highlights, John, that, a lot of these cases, and I who knows what's going to happen, but I think it's going to be, I think you're going to see a split in terms of the conservative versus the liberal justices. You're going to see a lot of them on one side. A lot of these issues are 9-0, 8-1, 7-2. It has nothing to do with, you don't see, not every decision is going to be a 5-4 based on, partisan line. So it's a good example of how the Supreme Court works. You're right.
Yeah, I guess in pointing it out, even for myself, talking with lawyer extraordinaire Jeff O'Brien, to make sure that we keep that in mind when the Supreme Court ends up ruling on a particular issue that doesn't go the way that, a conservative would want it to go. And again, that's not to say that bias can't be involved, but it is to say that, moving forward as we approach those particular controversies as they come out of Supreme Court decisions, it's always healthy to kind of stop and go, let's pump the brakes here and look at exactly what it is they ruled and why they ruled it, as opposed to just strictly falling down, party lines and, sort of running with an argument one way or the other, depending on the outcome of a particular decision. So getting back to the issue of this internet speech case, to your point, Justice Elena Kagan warned that the narrowing of Section 230 could lead to a wave of lawsuits. Article that I'm reading here from out of CNN, even if many of them would eventually be thrown out in a line of questioning with the U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart. Chief Justice John Roberts mused that under a narrowed version of Section 230, terrorism-related cases might only be a small share of a much wider range of future lawsuits against websites alleging antitrust violations, discrimination, defamation, and infliction of emotional distress, just to name a few. And I think that speaks to both of those views of Roberts and Kagan, speaks to what you were mentioning a moment ago, that they may not have the stomach to cast a ruling on this and may want this decided, you know, via Congress, which would be, you know, an entirely different ballgame altogether. But it certainly would appear that that's the way that they would be leaning based on those comments.
Well, and I would say, John, it's not that I don't think that they have the stomach for it. I think that they properly recognize what the Supreme Court's role is. I mean, that was the,
the
criticism of the court from conservatives for decades, the legislating from the bench. And if there's one thing, you know, I know conservatives get frustrated with Chief Justice Roberts. I think he's a fascinating guy. I think that if you can tie one theme through all of the decisions of the court since he became Chief Justice, it is that. It is, we are not going to substitute our views for the Congress. And if you don't like something they've done, go vote somebody else in and have Congress change it. Stop coming to us. And I think that it's not judicial activism going the other way. That's not what this conservative majority is. It is kind of adhering to what the Constitution provides. And if you see this, last year when they struck down the executive orders on the vaccine mandate, that was executive action. They said that basically that he was, you know, the president was usurping the role of the legislative branch. They adhere to that. They want laws to be made in Congress, not through other branches of government. And I think that's a good thing.
Eric Schnapper, representing the plaintiffs, argued that a ruling for Gonzalez would not have far-reaching effects because even if websites could face new liability as a result of the ruling, most suits would likely be thrown out anyway. However, it's interesting, just one more point on this, and we can move over to the legalization of marijuana as it relates to the beverage industry here in the state. One of the few justices focusing on how changes to Section 230 could affect individual internet users was Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who repeatedly asked whether narrowing the law in the ways that Schnapper has proposed could put average social media users in legal jeopardy. The text of Section 230 explicitly immunizes users, and not just social media platforms, from liability for the content posted by third parties. So a change that exposes tech platforms to new platforms could also have implications for users, according to several amicus briefs. You know, and the Section 230, I think, often gets a bad rap, especially among conservative circles when we end up discussing, you know, what do we do with the future of the internet? And when we were looking at issues of censorship by social media platforms, it's not so cut and dry to just go as Amy Coney Barrett was, as the justice was laying out. It really just isn't as cut and dry as everybody seems. There's a host of implications that take place if you were to go and put in any sort of significant changes to Section 230 as it relates to our platforms. But it seems like a lot of people take this, we just need to throw it out. And it's like, man, that's just not that, it's not that simple.
No, and I think that Section 230 is going to become, in the years to come, like the antitrust exemption that have been granted to professional sports leagues, if you're familiar with that, John, where if Congress doesn't like something that the leagues are doing, they make noise about, you know, removing the antitrust exemption, right? So I can see this cut from time to time. This is their kind of the invisible hand over the internet, right? If they don't like something that's going on at the tech companies or the social media companies, somebody will make noise about Section 230 and all of a sudden miraculously something will change. So I think you're going to see more of that. I don't think you're going to see, any action on Section 230, narrowing the scope, for whatever reason, anytime soon.
Talking with lawyer extraordinaire Jeff O'Brien on a friend of the show Friday here on Twin Cities News Talk. Let's turn our attention over to the marijuana legalization bill and Minnesota's unique THC beverage industry and the impact that it would have on that. I have a piece here from the Star Tribune, but Jeff O'Brien, I know that you're heavily involved in this, have a lot of views on it. So I'll kind of just hand it over to you and ask, what kind of impact would the legalization of recreational marijuana here in Minnesota end up having on those breweries? And I guess specifically those ones that are now creating THC-derived beverages, which have proven to be quite popular among these different breweries.
Yeah, they have, and they've also helped put revenue back in the coffers for some of these breweries that got hit pretty hard during the lockdowns that you were talking about earlier with the with Governor Walz and his peacetime emergency powers. And just full disclosure for the listeners, and I have a lot of brewery clients, I have some hemp clients, and I have cannabis clients outside of Minnesota. I'm in full favor of legalization, full legalization, but I also want it done right. And I was a little bit shocked to hear that in the this 302-page bill legalizing marijuana, which I don't know that you need 302 pages to legalize a plant that grows naturally, but that's neither here nor there. Why you would not allow it, what they're talking about having these beverages, we're talking about non-alcoholic THC infused beverages, because you can't get a formula with an alcoholic beverage approved by the feds with THC in it. That you have to have them made at like separate facilities. So basically the breweries couldn't be making what they're doing now at their existing production facility, which is, of course, going to add another layer of complexity and cost and would essentially bar them from the market. I don't know why. I've heard, I think it was Zach Stevenson, the chair of the Commerce Committee, has said, we will address this, we will fix this. So I'm cautiously optimistic that it's going to be addressed. But I don't know who thought of leaving that out in the original draft, because it's been a good thing for the brewery. So I hope that it does get back in the bill.
Yeah, and a couple of things on this. From the Star Tribune article, it said one concern is a requirement in the bill that cannabis manufacturing must take place on equipment that is used exclusively for the manufacture of cannabinoid products. But I know that a lot of these breweries have come back and said, listen, we keep all of our equipment up to standard and standards as it relates to everything that we do. I mean, having that particular requirement would seem somewhat unnecessary and burdensome, on top of the potential tax and banking complications by combining marijuana and hemp in various definitions. It seems like there's a whole host of issues that could be brought up that just don't need to be there as it relates to the legalization, as you were mentioning, of marijuana THC alcoholic beverages.
Yeah, I think this is more, anytime you have the legislature making decisions about an industry, you're going to have special interests. And my hunch is that this came from lobbyists for the cannabis industry that sort of want to centralize everything hemp and cannabis under that industry rather than letting other players in the market have a piece of it. So that's my guess as to where it's coming from. Like I said, I do think it'll ultimately be addressed. I do think one thing I think that it probably will come out of this is I don't think you're going to have on-premise consumption of these beverages at breweries anymore. But Minnesota is unique in that regard in allowing that right now. And there's some dram shop issues for those familiar with dram shop, dram laws and liability. With especially with bars and restaurants, when people are mixing alcoholic beverages and those THC infused non-alcoholic beverages, can lead to some issues. And so I think there'll be some changes there, but I don't think that preventing them from making them at their existing facilities, like you said, John, they have pretty high standards of cleanliness and sanitation there. I don't doubt that they can. We haven't had any issues so far. I don't know why we would have any issues going forward with those.
Well, and I think in typically I would say, well, this is an opportunity for some bipartisan legislation to come up with the best solution. But unfortunately, right now, with what the DFL's been doing during the legislative session, that I kind of just throw that idea completely out the window. I mean, they're going to do whatever it is they want to do. Hopefully, they make the right decisions as it relates to this. But at the moment, saying right decisions and this legislative session, those two should not be combined in my mind, based off of what's happened so far.
It's concerning that they've taken this attitude of, if you don't like it, get out, and we're just going to do this. That's not healthy. And I think that they're doing it in a way of, you know, we're, you know, let's change some of the, you know, the voting laws and some things like that to make sure that we're always in the majority, that we don't have to care about the minority. That's not a good view. And certainly with the way that this state is split along urban and rural right now, this is really unhealthy, what is going on at the legislature.
Jeff O'Brien, lawyer extraordinaire, thank you so much for the time this morning. Go take care of Toro the Conqueror, and we'll certainly have you on again real soon, my friend.
Sounds good. Thanks, John.